Welcome everyone to another ACA member prospect call. Today's members are Phil Watson, who's a CFP down in Tennessee, and we also have Mark Foldman. Mark is a CHFC, and Mark, you're in Michigan, right?
Traverse City.
Okay. So either gentleman, do you care who goes first?
No, it doesn't matter to me.
Phil's a good leader. I'll follow him.
Okay, Phil, if you want to talk about why you joined ACA and why you stay.
Okay. Well, welcome to the prospects that are with us. Was it Jim and Tim? Is that who's with us?
Yes.
Okay. My name is Phil Watson. I have an office in Franklin, Tennessee, which is a suburb of Nashville, Tennessee. We're about 20 miles south of Nashville. And as Mark alluded to a minute ago, we did undergo a horrific flood event the first of the month that so far I think there's upwards of 30,000 people that have applied for FEMA aid. I am a career changer. I was a professional musician for about 20 years here in the Nashville area. My father passed away in 1994 and left an estate that needed some management, and I had no inkling of how to work with numbers. If it didn't have strings on it, I didn't know how to do it. I began to ask questions and of the financial people that were involved with my dad's investments, and I didn't like the answers that I heard. Continued to ask lots of questions and always felt like I was hearing a sales pitch rather than true financial advice. To make a long story short, at one point I decided that in order to get the advice that I needed, I was going to have to become my own source. And so I went to the College for Financial Planning and took the Paraplanner course, which then led me to the full CFP course. And I sort of got on a train and couldn't get off and realized that I liked the train once I was on. So I finished the CFP coursework, went back to college and finished a finance degree that I had started 20-some-odd years earlier, and then went back to the College for Financial Planning and finished their master's program. I hung out a shingle in 2001 as a CFP and practiced for about 3 years on my own. And then I picked up a copy of John Sestina's book about fee-only financial planning. And that reacquainted me with the models that were out there opened my eyes again to the models that were out there, the Garrett model, John Sestina's model, and an ACA. And so I investigated those again, but coming into it with 3 years of experience and 3 years of trying to reinvent the wheel. And the appeal of Cambridge over the other two models was its tax-centered focus. Most of all the people that had come to see me in the previous 3 years, all of our discussions at some point involved taxes, and the thing that set one of the main concepts that set the ACA group or the Cambridge group apart from others was its central focus on taxes. I joined ACA in 2004. Have been extremely happy with it. It's a turnkey model. If you do the system from as is, you'll be successful. I remember hearing that from one of the instructors in the Denver class, that you're free to come out use pieces of this if you want and build a practice the way you want to. But if you do nothing other than just the system as is, you will be successful. And I think that there are lots of people that have done just that as they came out of the gate. And I think Mark will follow this up and explain that he set his practice up in such a way as the system dictates. There are some key concepts in Cambridge that I don't think I would have gotten elsewhere. One of those is the bond ladder, the concept using U.S. Treasury stripped bonds to build a defensive wall against the effects of a deflationary environment. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, who would have thought that deflation would have been an issue that we would need to build a defensive wall against. But the wisdom of Burt Whitehead and others in the Cambridge group built a system that said we have three economic scenarios that we need to be prepared for at all times, and that's inflation, deflation, and growth. And within the context of a balanced portfolio, we have the ability to park assets in a balanced portfolio that will do just that. We can defend ourselves against deflation. We can defend ourselves against the eroding effects of inflation, and we can participate in growth when it does occur if we are using the right tools. And the concept of using the bond ladder for our pre-retirees for our retirees and begin to build, at least in our pre-retiring age group, is key to one of the things, is one of the key things that the Cambridge group brought to me. And that's one of the things that I'm most passionate about. With that said, I guess I'll turn it over to Mark and let him talk about his practice.
Okay, get me off of mute. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Phil. I have a completely different background than Phil. I started out in the financial services industry in 1983. With a company called IDS, Investors Diversified Services. So when I made my cold calls back in the 80s, and I let people know I was from IDS, the first question we got in Michigan was, oh, International Dating Service. So then I had to go and explain to them, no, not International Dating Service, Investors Diversified Services. We didn't have financial planning. The concept wasn't even, the term wasn't even created back then. We pretty much went into individuals' homes and would get them saving money in mutual funds and selling them some term insurance. In 84, American Express showed up and bought IDS for $1 billion. And kind of took us in a new direction with this thing called financial planning. I can remember interviewing new potential planners back in the early 80s, and they would come in and tell me that they wanted to be fee-only planners, and we would just absolutely laugh at them. I mean, it was the funniest thing we ever heard, that somebody would want to be a fee-only planner and charge an hourly fee or retainer or whatever else. Typically, at least all the ones we ran into, none of them had any success. And during that time, you know, obviously American Express took over the company. They turned it eventually into IDS American Express, and then there was another transition that made them American Express Financial Advisors. When that happened, one day, October something of 98, my boss, who I was part of the Detroit region at that time, we were number one in the nation for American Express. We had about 400 planners. My boss came in one morning. We had a manager's meeting, and I was in management. I had kind of progressed through the system and was running a pretty large district at that time. My boss came in one morning in October of 98 and said, well, it's been a great run. Now, he was about 35 years old, making probably $1.5 million a year. He walked in and says, it's been a great run, I'm leaving, and I'm going to go start my own company. Well, that was about 9:30 in the morning, and by noon, 150 of us had faxed in our resumes. No one checked with their spouses or their significant others. We just all quit, and next morning we were working in his basement, forming a new company. The following day, we were on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, and from that point, we spent the next 8 years or so, at least I spent the next 8 years through 2004 as senior vice president for that regional brokerage house. We started with zero planners. Well, I mean, the 150 of us that quit, but we didn't have offices, we didn't have product, we didn't have anything, so we were going to build a better mousetrap. We were going to do it better than American Express. So it was quite exciting and a great run. went from zero revenue to, when I left 8 years later, we were doing about 55 million a year of gross revenue. We had grown to over 500 planters. And lo and behold, we looked just like American Express, except for we were making a lot more money because we didn't have the huge overhead and the bureaucracy that American Express had. So it was, like I say, it was fairly exciting. Corporate-wise, we had three Learjets, a soccer team, pro soccer team, and NASCAR in ARCA, or race car. So there was tons of money being made, but the problem was it wasn't necessarily from the clients. The clients weren't benefiting as much, as at least in my mind, as the company was. So I became really, really concerned as we grew larger and larger, and kept pushing the buttons and asking the questions, and why don't we do this, and wouldn't this be better, and no one wanted to hear that. You know, like in every corporate environment, it's profit, profit, profit. And we got to a point where, you know, I just had to sit back and start to look at what I really wanted to do. And it had nothing to do with selling products and figuring profit and everybody hitting their revenue goals for the week. It had to do with actually, you know, helping some people on some areas that they really needed help in a way that was that I felt good about. So I like Phil, I started my investigations. I read, you know, when I typically get into something, I'll drill extremely deep, and I probably read 15 to 20 books on from everybody and anybody that wrote on the subject of fee-only planning. And I eventually ran into a book written by Bob Verres, and he had mentioned Bird in the book. Well, his book was phenomenal to me because it kind of laid out a path of where the industry was going. But when I got to Burt, and by the way, his book is The Cutting Edge in Financial Services. Now it's become a little dated, and I got it right in front of me on my desk here, and becoming maybe a little dated, but it laid out a path where this industry was going to go. And like anything else, when we read something we kind of agree with, we really like it. So it confirmed some of my own thoughts and led me to Burt. And then once I got into Burt's organization, I started calling Cambridge Advisors, and I must have called 15 or 20 of them. And they all loved building their practices, and even the ones that were broke loved building their practices. So it wasn't about money. It was truly about cutting-edge planning strategies and being able to help the marketplace in a way that they felt good about. And one thing led to another, and by the way, I was trying real hard not to go fee-only at that time. And in early 2004 is when I was really doing that investigation. I was going to make the move and go to a broker-dealer and, you know, take all the things I learned over the years and do it in a way that, you know, I was going to do it ethically through product sales. And you know, all of this just kept pulling me in a direction, and finally I got to the point where Burt and I would talk periodically, Burt Whitehead, who was the founder of Cambridge. And, you know, like me, like many others, he just, in his own way, convinced me that this is really where I wanted to be, and it's what I needed to do. And finally, in mid-04, I made that decision. And lo and behold, the other gentleman on the call, Phil Watson, him and I ended up sitting next to each other in our initial training in Colorado to become Cambridge advisors. So that's kind of what got me to Cambridge. Obviously, we just passed Phil and I passed our five-year anniversary. My practice has kind of evolved exactly like I envisioned it. I have 32 full retainer clients, and I have five institutional 401k clients where I oversee their 401ks. So, you know, the growth has been consistent and regular and kind of pretty much planned. I'm very happy with what's happened in my career with Cambridge. Why I stay at this point has nothing to do with Cambridge itself. I now really don't believe I have any need nor use for Cambridge. But why I stay at this point is collective minds, for lack of a better way to put it. I believe we have a really, really talented group of individuals. And the collective minds that are involved, I believe, can take us to new, wonderful places, of which I have no idea what that will look like. I have thoughts and I have ideas and I have ambitions. But, you know, so much has even evolved in the last couple of years as far as potential opportunities and what we can do as a group and those kinds of things. That's really the only reason I stay. I tell everybody, Cambridge is phenomenal, and I agree with Phil. If you just do the system, you know, it's like McDonald's. You know, you got to try really hard to mess it up. And by the way, you know, we see a lot of people mess it up. You know, I don't know for sure, maybe Phil can say, but I want to say there was 12 people in our training group, and there's probably four or five of us left. The other ones, I watched them try to build their own mousetrap. I mean, you know, they opened their McDonald's, and they didn't want a drive-in window, and they didn't want to serve breakfast, and, you know, they wanted to just take a little teeny piece of Cambridge and try to implement that into their system. And it doesn't really work that way because the overlaying philosophies, and Phil was mentioning them, the bond ladder, the, you know, the functional asset allocation, properly leveraged real estate, all of the philosophies that are involved in the process and the system are all linked together. So when, you know, if you take one little piece, it just doesn't seem to work effectively and you can't deliver it. So, you know, that's why I stay. I stay for the minds. You know, there's over the course of the 5 years, there's 10 or 20 people that I really respect. I mean, there's some talented, ethical, conscientious people. And by the way, Phil is one of those that I simply want to be around. And for my renewal fees to be around, that's worth it to me. You know, from an organization standpoint, my practice is up and running. I don't really need Cambridge anymore. But I really enjoy being around the people. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thank you, Mark. That was great. And thank you, Phil. Any questions? And don't forget to hit *6 to unmute your phones.
This is Tim Williams speaking. Thanks. That was very helpful from both of the gentlemen. I have a question. I'd like to get a little more information about the folks that didn't make it. Are you suggesting that there are particular ways that people deviated from the program that messed up, or you just think that if it isn't implemented as an integrated system, that in general, regardless of what the particular flare is, that they're going to, you know, that you're going to get off the road?
You want me to answer that, Phil, then you can
sure,
follow
go ahead,
up? I get the opportunity. I interview, I'm one of the people at Cambridge that interview all the new members. So I'm in a unique situation where I get to see half of everybody that joins. I interview them. So they kind of don't get in till I have an opportunity to talk to them for an hour and then sign off on them. So I see two distinct areas of why people don't make it at Cambridge. One is they deviate from the system and they try to take such a small percent of the system and implement it into their existing, they think there's going to be some magical bullet. They built this financial service firm. Maybe they're managing money for assets under management, and they have no time to themselves. Their business has consumed them, and then they're going to bring in the Cambridge system, and they're going to try to implement 3 or 5 or 10% of it, and it doesn't really make any change. And then they get frustrated, and then they move on. So that's one scenario. The other scenario I see is that we have so many career changers in our industry. And what happens with career changers is they come into Cambridge looking for Cambridge to be a marketing organization. We're horrible at marketing. I mean, you know, that's just the way it is. We are not sales. I was a salesperson for most of my life. So when I say that, I look around at the other advisors. They're not salespeople. We have, you know, musicians like Phil and professors and computer programmers and tech people. And, you know, so they're not marketers. And they come in with this expectation that Cambridge is going to put people at your door. And, you know, yeah, we're evolving, and Cambridge is probably helping in those lines. And I don't want to step on, you know, some of the programs that are going on. But the reality is we're just not very good at it. What Cambridge gives is it gives a phenomenal process, you know, that once a potential client is at your table, then you have nothing to worry about at that point forward, nothing. You will have a process and a system to make that person want to pay you for the rest of your life. But in reality, I think I've gotten one client through Cambridge in 5 years. So I need other avenues to acquire clients, you know, through my NAPFA referrals, through my existing client referrals, through, you know, whatever marketing things you're going to do on your own. So I see both. I probably see more fail because they don't know how to get clients to their table, less using parts of the system, because as we add people, at least the ones I'm interviewing, half of them, most of them are looking for the process. And I'm very clear when I interview somebody and they come into Cambridge, you know, I tell them, you know, don't look for Cambridge to put people at your desk. If you do, you're making a fatal error in the system. And I, you know, back when Phil and I came in, there was no interview on the front end. So when they came in, I fill out an application. If I was breathing, I got in. It's not that way anymore. So, you know, you actually have to get through some gatekeepers. And, you know, many of you think that, you know, you're interviewing Amy. Well, I got news for you. Amy's probably interviewing you. And the reality is you don't ever get to me for a membership application unless you get through a lot of preliminary, and there's a lot of people that feel very comfortable about who you are and what you believe in and how you will add to this organization. So, you know, it's a pretty big misconception there. You know, that I charge for my first interviews when I meet with a client now, because, you know, I don't really want any more clients. So one of the ways I started slowing that down was I charge $500 for 2 hours, and I tell them up front, I'm not giving you any ideas and I'm not giving you any recommendations. So you come in as a new client, I charge you $500. I'm not going to tell you anything except for what I think. So in effect, I'm just charging them to interview them. That's all I'm doing. Well, ever since that's happened, I'm getting more clients now. I can't figure out how this works. But the idea here is they think that they're coming in to interview me. They're never interviewing me. So, you know, that may be a byproduct, but the reality is I'm deciding whether I want to work with this person for the next 20 years. And now the ACA system, in my mind, is getting closer to that, where, you know, we didn't have any gatekeepers when Phil and I, like I say, if we fogged the mirror, we were getting in. And I don't think it's so much that anymore. So I know that's a long answer, and I apologize, but that's kind of my take on why people don't make it.
Okay, thanks. Phil,
Mark, I don't have an awful lot to add. I'll contrast the way you did it, because I admired so much about the way you came out of the gate, and I was one that did not do the system, did not do the system in its pure form from the get-go, and I paid the price for that. It took me longer to build my practice. If I remember correctly, and you correct me if I don't, I think you had reached the goals you had set, the numbers that you had set for yourself within the first year of your practice. After we left training, you went out and you did use the marketing concepts and the marketing tools that are in place for us. and that you had the founders group or the French club, I think, that, as Bert used to call it, you presented and guys, this founders group or French club concept is simply taking this new business model that you're about to embark upon and presenting it to friends, family, acquaintances, and say, here's what I'm about to do. What do you think? And beginning to network out from that circle. And Mark, I believe that's exactly what you did. And please elaborate on that a little bit, on how you within the first year reached your targets.
Yeah, I mean, since I came from corporate world and I was in management, I didn't have any clients. So that was obviously was a concern of mine when I came in. And Bert just simply told me, he says, don't worry about it. He says, do what I did. Go identify 12 of your ideal clients. You get to set the criteria. In your whole world, you know, if you had a wedding, you'd probably invite 200 people if you had no restrictions on the bill. He says, you know all these people in your universe. Identify a dozen of them that you would really love to work with and you would want as clients and you think they're successful. And go. Now, here's the tough part. You got to go introduce yourself and what you're trying to do and call them and book an appointment and bring them in and let them know they're kind of the guinea pigs, but you want to work with them. So I did that with 12, and 10 agreed to meet. 8 hired me immediately. 1 hired me within the next 12 months, so 9 out of the 10 that met with me became clients. And then I got, 4 referrals from them, and I got 4 NAPFA referrals, and I think I had 18 clients or so in my first year. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't deviate from what Bert laid out for me, and, you know, I didn't try to outthink it. I just implemented what he said. But, you know, to be honest, I see very few people that will do that because, you know, that's kind of a tough thing to do is go identify 12 people and then put them all at your desk. You know, that's outside the comfort zone of many people. But I didn't really have any choice. So, yeah, I mean, you know, within 12 months I hit 6 figures of revenue and we were off to the races. The process works.
Great, thanks.
And don't be shy. You guys can ask us anything you'd like. I mean, I don't think there's no out of bounds questions. So, in the financial world, you can pretty much got to get used to asking people anything.
All right, this is Tim Williams again. I'll ask a question that I've been thinking about for a while because I've done quite a bit of due diligence on the difference between fee-only practice, fee-based practice, selling product, blah, blah, blah. So I'm definitely attracted to the ACA fee-only model and specifically the ACA model. I like the annual retainer and the system and the process. So everything you just said is very appealing. I have a kind of a sideways question that's related to something that everybody has to decide, which is the name of the firm. I mean, it seems to me that there's two schools of thought out there about naming the firm after yourself, you know, versus naming it some clever name that has to do with, Nirvana or peaceful sleep or whatever. I mean, what are your thoughts about naming a firm after yourself versus naming a firm some clever name?
Since we got Phil Watson and ARC Advisors, we probably got both sides, huh, Phil?
Yeah, we got both sides to this one.
I only have one word, irrelevant. You take it over, Phil, from there.
Fair enough. Thanks a lot.
I will agree with Mark that don't spin your wheels on this one. And that comes from someone who has spun his wheels on the naming of my firm. But don't spin your wheels. Don't waste your time. It really is irrelevant.
Okay, thanks.
You mentioned the I'll chime in here. You mentioned the difference fee based versus fee only. Do you know the difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think I do.
What's the difference?
Well, fee based is in my opinion a way of trying to straddle both worlds.
What's it mean to the client?
I don't know that it really means anything. I think most people are confused.
Well, go to my blog. I wrote an article last week on fee-based versus fee-only.
Okay.
And why they're not the same. Okay. ArcAdvisor.com, you can get on my blog.
Okay, will do.
But the reality is the fee-based is just a marketing term to cloud the, you know, blur the field of vision. And the broker-dealers, what they do is they take very expensive, high turnover funds that would probably, with transaction costs and everything, come in at maybe 200, 250 basis points. And then they wrap a fee on top of anywhere from 1 to 200 basis points and call it a fee-based account. So the reality is you end up with somewhere between 350 and 450 basis points in cost inside that fee-based account. You know, and so if you have a reasonable portfolio that's going to return 8% or 8.5% per year, you've sucked off over 50% of that potential growth of that account in fees. Where fee only is the complete opposite. What we create is low cost, low turnover, very efficient portfolios that may have an all in cost of many times 10 basis points. You know, with transaction costs, they may go up to 15 basis points. And typically, if you know, we don't charge this way, but if you factored in my cost and so forth, all-in costs, including the advisor costs, many times don't even hit 75 basis points. So if we have that same portfolio created and it's going to return 8.5%, if the expected rate of return of that portfolio is 8.5%, and in that fee-based account we lose 4.5% to fees for a net return of 4%, in the fee-only account, if it's 8.5 and we lose 75 basis points to fees, we're netting 7.75. And then you project that out over 10, 20, 30 years on a reasonable-sized portfolio, you know, it very well may be $1 million difference.
Sure.
So, but nobody makes that clear in the marketplace. You know, nobody explains that to an individual, and they never understand the difference. You know, they think, well, fee-based, well, everybody's on it, and they use all the same words. Hey, I'm fee-based, so we're sitting on the same side of the table. When you take a loss, I take a loss. But what they don't tell you is I'm taking 50% of your returns off the top. You know, the verbiage sounds really, really good. And, you know, again, since I was in that world, I know the verbiage. But, hey, I created some of the verbiage, for crying out loud. You know, so I'm not bragging about that. I'm ashamed of that, but that's the reality.
Okay.
Tim, if I could add, the consumers do not know the difference between fee-only and fee-based, but we know the difference between fee-only and fee-based. And to a person within the ACA organization, we're all passionate about being fee-only. That's probably, that is our core. I know I wouldn't work in this industry in any other way than fee-only. And I think if that question were posed to other advisors, they would agree. So once you do know the difference, and if you've gone through the CFP program, you do know the difference. And once you've been, your interest has been piqued by the differences in fee only and fee based, there is no, in my mind, there's no turning back. Once you've been exposed to the real difference between fee only and fee based, and what value that brings to our fellow human beings, then you can't turn back, and you can't go to the other side. And we like to refer to that as the dark side. So that's my core passion is fee only.
Great. Well, I'm there too. I mean, I'm fortunate enough to be in a position that I've had the time to do the due diligence and have interviewed with several firms that wanted to do the fee-based and quickly saw through the veil. So I'm definitely on the side of fee-only.
Well, count yourself as an enlightened, unique individual, because there aren't, to see through that veil, even within the industry, there's lots of people who can't see through that veil. And you're a valuable person to the community because you can.
Yeah, another side note is I don't want to upset Amy, but, you know, we tend as at that ACA is kind of touting ourselves as middle-income American planners. I don't believe that's true, just as a side note. I don't think we're middle-income America planners. None of my clients, for the most part, are middle-income America. I think by definition, middle-income America is, you know, household income of $48,000 and a net worth of, you know, I don't know, $12,000 or something. So, you know, I, you know, as you do your due diligence, you know, we're upper middle income America planners at worst. You know, typically we're charging thousands of dollars on an annual basis to advise clients. And if you're making $42,000 trying to you know, make your car payment, you're typically not going to be able to hire us. So you need to be aware of that. And you know, we're there's very distinct separate groups that you know, if you looked at the two models, I tell people when I interview them as new planners with, when they're coming through the system, you know, the Garrett model, the hourly model, is more middle income America planners. You know, we're, in my mind, we serve a complete, there's overlap, don't get me wrong, but in general, I think we serve a completely different portion of the marketplace, and because of the way we charge on a retainer basis. So, you know, you shouldn't be confused on that, and you should know that going in.
Well, thanks for elaborating on that. That's actually an aspect of the ACA model that is appealing to me, because I've spent quite a number of months talking with different folks in the Garrett organization and running some numbers, and the hang-up that I had about them is that it's really hard to build a practice, and that is appealing to what's appealing about the ACA system, among many things, is that aspect of it. I mean, I understand there's some trade-offs there in terms of, you know, who can afford your services, but leaving all that aside, I like the idea that you can build a practice and do some good, but at the same time, you know, make
right. Right, and you know, and it's not a contradiction. There's no problem with that, as long as you understand that going in. The reality is there's way more clients that can afford Garrett than us. That means that 80% or 90% of the population, you know, is a good match for the Garrett model, and a smaller percentage of the population is a good match for our model. The beautiful part is, I mean, Phil, how many do you have? How many retainers do you have, Phil?
38.
Okay. Wow, you passed me. Congratulations.
Probably not as high quality as yours.
Yeah, well, but the reality is we need 30 or 40 of these clients out of, you know, I showed Phil my marketing plan when we were back in training, and, you know, like 60 million baby boomers retire, and I need 30. I mean, it's pretty, how tough is that, for crying out loud? If you can't find 30 clients out of 60 million, you know, again, not 60 million of them wouldn't fit that criteria, but you get the idea. We need such a small number of really good clients that love what we do and are willing to work together as a team and a partnership on a long-term basis, that now you got to be a lot better at what you do to get them to say yes to you, because, you know, it's a lot easier for somebody to write a check for $150 for an hour of advice than to write a check for $7,000 for a first-year retainer. So you've got to be much, much better at what you do, which is why you, in my mind, you need the Cambridge model. I mean, that the model, those first eight clients that hired me, I started each one of them on a different appointment, like one on tax planning, one on budgeting, one on goals, one on estate planning, one on insurance. So by the time I had those eight people hired me, I had done one appointment from every piece of the model, and I got to learn it really quick. So, and that allowed me to be better at, as I started to have new people coming in that didn't cut me so much slack. But yeah, it's a different model. I tell You know, like I read a paper up here, article for the local paper, and I'm constantly trying to get an hourly planner up here in Traverse City. We don't have any hourly planners. Nobody wants to do the work. But the reality is the majority of the people that live in Traverse City need an hourly planner. They can't afford me. They're never going to be able to afford me. They need somebody to help them for a couple hours a year, and nobody wants to do the work. Well, I don't want to say nobody wants to do the work, but you know, for some reason, we don't have an hourly planner here. We got a lot of commission people, and we got a lot of high-end planner, fee-only planners, but we don't have anybody in between. So,
that was great. Any more questions?
Yes, hi, this is Jim. I did have a question. You talked earlier about the business name was irrelevant, but what about the business entity structure? What do most of the planners have as far as their entity structure and also forming their RIA, registering with the state or the SEC?
Mark, I'll take this one first,
okay,
if you don't mind.
No, go.
I'm still a sole proprietor. I'm registered with the state of Tennessee. I don't take assets in, I don't take custody of my clients' assets, nor do I take assets under management. I don't see myself as a too large of a target at this point. The LLC will be my next step at some point in the near future, but it's not something that would be a deal breaker for me if I were starting a new practice to immediately think that I would need to go out and form an LLC to protect myself from potential liabilities. It may be naive on my part, but I don't see myself engaging in too many issues that would present those liabilities. Especially since I'm not taking custody of my clients' assets. Was there a second part to that question?
Or just you know, registering an LLC, or and also registering with the state as an RIA.
I think the criteria for whether you would be registering with the SEC or the state is still assets under management, or whether you're going to be crossing borders and things like that. But for the most part, most of us starting out would be state registered RIAs.
Okay, thank you.
And I just started out as an LLC from day one. I mean, it's I set up a separate entity, and since my company's not Mark Fogman, it's Arc Advisors, I just set up. It's so easy to set up an LLC. That's what I did. There's a lot of planners that use corporations. Again, I think based on what Phil told you is our real answer would be irrelevant. You know, credit to Phil, the mark of a true fiduciary. Not trying to protect himself, but yet just doing good and not worrying about it. So,
thank you.
Any other questions?
Did you both start out with shared office space of some kind, or just, you know, rent office space on an as-needed basis as opposed to committing to any kind of a office space that had a long-term lease or, you know, a yearly lease? How did you handle that?
I'll go with this one. I started out in my home. Remember, I came from corporate world, so I tried everything that would stop me from being successful. I did not get an office. I burned all. To this day, I do not own a suit or a tie. My home was in the middle of rural Michigan. I had no access to clients that were closer than really a half an hour from me. So I tried everything to non-conform after I left the corporate world, and it didn't matter. It still worked. After 3 years, I moved to northern Michigan, which is about 4.5 hours from where I started my practice, and retained all of my clients, and now I am all virtual. So I for the most part, I have added a few clients up here in Traverse City, but I see nobody now. So all of my and we didn't mention this, but the beautiful part of Cambridge is it's structured in a way where you never have to be face-to-face with a client. As I stated that, you know, I just brought on a new client, a referral in St. Louis, or Grafton, Illinois, and I will probably never meet them until they get up here, and they're possibly talking about coming up here next year. But we do all our work over the Internet. I put them on my laptop, and the tools are conducive to all of our meetings. It's wonderful. I'm sitting in shorts. I'm typically always in shorts and a T-shirt. So when I moved up here to Traverse City after 3 years, I took one office. I added a second office because my son has now come to work with me. And now I just redid my lease, and we're turning it into a suite. So we're going to put up a wall in the building I'm in, and I've got three offices now. So kind of I've evolved into that. I really thought I was just going to stay in my home when I started, and I just had a desire to have a small kind of boutique, work with who I want. But, you know, now my kids want to work with me, and I'm having fun working with other planners. So we're probably going to grow for a little while. So. And Phil, I think you started right off in an office. Everything we did was the opposite, Phil.
Well, you know, the only thing that I can add is that within the Cambridge organization, you'll find the whole range. We've got a real successful advisor that I think she's out in Arizona that practices out of her home. And I think you go in her front door and go past the children's bedroom back to her office, and she's accepting no new clients. She's got a full practice, a thriving practice. And then you can go to the other extreme, and we've got multi-planner businesses with a couple of $1 billion under management in one sort of or another. I hate to use the word irrelevant again, you guys are doing you're doing all the things that I did coming in. I thought about my name, thought about what type of a business organization I should be, thought about
what
whether
kind
I should
of phone
have an office.
System I get, you know, what email am I going to use?
Yeah, all of that. And and the real important thing is just focusing on the concept of bringing true fiduciary fee-only advice to this to the public out here that is in such need, and finding your 30 out of the 60 million baby boomers and building a practice. And you can do it from your home, you can do it from an office suite. You need to come to terms with your own values and build your practice the way you want it. Do you want your lifestyle to be like Mark's? Do you want to be able to sit in shorts and T-shirt and operate out of your home? Then you can do that, and Cambridge will assist you in doing that.
Robert Welch, who's in my mind as successful a planner as we have in our organization, when he was one of those first ones that I called before I joined, and he says, "Mark, this is not rocket science." He says, "Think of yourself as a painter. You need a paintbrush, a ladder, and a bucket." And he says, "The paintbrush is your phone, the ladder is your desk, and the bucket is your computer. Other than that, go see some people."
Okay, fair enough.
And it, you know, I mean, I don't want to take it to, but he's right. Here 5 years later, he's absolutely right. So,
you guys need to convince yourself that this is doable. And I hear the same hesitation in your voices that I had starting out. All of us have, we all doubt whether or not we can do this, but this is doable. We have a new member that just came in the last training class, and I actually was privileged and he's in my area, and I know him, and he's extremely confident. I asked him, I said, "Well, how do you think you're going to do?" And he said, "I'm going to hit it out of the park." And that's really the attitude that we all need to have when we undertake something like this. We need to go into it planning on hitting it out of the park, and Cambridge will help you do that.
Great.
great questions. Any others? No? Okay. Well, I want to wish everybody a very happy Memorial Day weekend. And I really want to thank Phil and Mark for taking time out of their calendar to be on this call today, because I know that a lot of people listen to these calls on the websites. This is recorded. It's going to be posted to our website for other people to listen to. And Mark, don't worry, you didn't upset me at all with any of your comments.
Hey, there's a first. Hey, Phil, if you get underwater again, you're always welcome to come up and stay in Traverse.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right.
And guys, you should be thankful that there was no video associated with this, and we weren't put through the shorts and T-shirt of Mark.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. Thanks.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.